to get my haircut, so I'm going to recycle a talk that I used last year for the teachers. So everybody's been telling me that you guys are much smarter than the audience I had last year, so in case you find this boring or too simple, just ask me questions, interrupt me, or make paper planes and throw them in the air to show that you're bored, okay? So the idea is to describe you today what are the problems behind the quantization of general relativity, namely the merging of general relativity and the quantum mechanics. This is a problem that is more than 70 years long now. It has been approached in many different ways, and the solution have been looked for from many different perspectives, but we don't yet have a definite answer. The main reason being the fact that, as opposed to the rest of the theoretical physics, which was always developed in straight contact with experiments and with the phenomenology, in this field, this is not the case. There's no actual evidence or experiments that can tell us what is the right way to go. So typically you say that, do I also have a pointer? Oh yes, in here. So typically, to describe why these two theories are so different, you refer to the fact that they actually apply to very different regimes of our universe. In particular, general relativity is the theory that describes us how things gravitate, and typically finds its application in systems which are very large, like the solar system, galaxies, or the whole universe. On the other hand, quantum mechanics is the theory that tells us how small things, microscopic things, behave, and it finds its application in the subatomic world of particle physics. So one says, okay, we have two very different theories which describe in very different languages two very different regimes. So what is the reason, what is the need to actually try to put them together? So there are various reasons to actually be interested in doing so. If you want, the more philosophical being the fact that at some point we are interested in having a single coherent picture and description of the world for our better understanding. And there are also more technical reasons related to the fact that anyway, these two theories, even though both have been experimentally verified in a magnificent way, they both have regimes where they actually don't quite work well, when they produce answers which do not really make sense. And then when you find that in your theory an answer which doesn't really make sense, you might imagine that you've pushed your theory too far. You're trying to apply it to a regime where the theory doesn't work. And so it might be that there's the need for a better theory in that case. And so there are regions like the interior of black holes or the beginning of the universe in which you expect general relativity not to apply anymore, and so you might expect a theory that describes both at the same time to be the only description in that case. To give you an idea of what I mean by the fact that the theory doesn't apply anymore, you're probably familiar with the force of a spring. Hooke's force is called in English as well. So when you say that the spring gives you a force which is minus kx, where x is the distance, right? You know, have you ever seen this expression? Perfect. So you know that this expression actually only makes sense if you're in a regime in which the spring is not too much extended or too much compressed, namely the regime of linearity of that force. If you don't try to extend, if you take a real spring and you extend it a lot, you know that won't pull you back anymore because you basically break the spring. So you know that in that regime in which you have pulled the string too much, that theory, let me call it a theory, that description of the force doesn't make sense anymore, doesn't apply anymore. This is the sense in which I mean the generativity might not apply anymore. However, let's try to see if we can find a little bit of overlap between the two theories. First of all, let me, for instance, shrink a little bit the regime of application of generativity. We said that we use generativity for description of the Big Bang, the universe, but actually we find it also in much smaller objects like this funny cell phone here, which is now becoming extremely popular and easy to find. This is called the GPS system, and it's used, especially it was used on boats, but now you can find it even in your cell phones almost, and it tells you with an extraordinary precision where you are located on Earth. It has an approximation of a meter. It's something extraordinary. In order to work and gives you this approximation so well, it has to know about general relativity. Why? So in order to tell you where you are, these things connect with four satellites which are up in orbit. However, you might have seen from the lectures on special relativity that observers which move with a different speed with respect to each other experience time in a different way. You are familiar with this concept, right? And in fact, the theory is called special relativity because it refers only to the special cases of observers which are related by a constant speed to each other. 10 years later, Einstein developed his general relativity theory, which refers to any observers in any motion with respect to each other. And he found that not only if you are at a different speed with respect to each other, you experience different time, but also if you are in different gravitational wells. So if you experience a different gravitational force, you will experience time in a different way. Your time will flow differently. And there's no doubt that the gravity force which we feel on the surface of the Earth is different from the gravity force that you will feel hundreds of kilometers higher up in the atmosphere as the satellite would do. This effect, one might think that is absolutely negligible, the difference, but it turns out that this is not the case. And in order to achieve the precision of a meter in the GPS, you need to take this correction into account, the fact that time runs differently in the satellites than how it does on Earth. Another point where there might be unexpected contact between the two theories is, for instance, in a description of a nebula like this. This is Orion's nebula. So general relativity, or better, the theory of in this case, it's enough Newton's theory. So anyway, our classical theory of gravity tells us about the shape of this nebula and why this nebula would be formed by gas that would stay together instead of just drifting away and evaporating away. Quantum theory, on the other hand, is going to tell us why the nebula is actually of this color. Because you might expect a wider variety of colors in the nebula. However, you might have heard about the fact that actually the energy levels in the hydrogen atom are discrete. There's only a certain amount of energy steps that you can have when you move an electron in an hydrogen atom. So basically what happens typically in red nebulas is that the energy coming from stars or a single star behind it ionize the hydrogen atoms in the cloud. And then when these electrons come back and fall back into their ground state, they emit according to a well-defined frequency, which was studied at the beginning of the century. And a well-defined frequency means also a well-defined color. And this is the reason why, for instance, hydrogen nebulas are red, and now I don't remember all the colors, but all the other green and blue nebulas can be related to the presence of other elements in the gas. So in a sense, quantum theory is explaining this very larger scale phenomena than the usual subatomic description. So I should also assume that you're probably a little bit familiar with the basics, because you have seen the little of the basics of general relativity, because you've seen the little game down in the lobby where you have these sort of little surface where you can put the balls and see how they spin around and sort of gravitate in respect to each other. So the idea behind general relativity is the fact that in order to describe the force of gravity, you can actually use the concept of curved space instead of the concept of a force as for the other theories. Let me give you an example here. To make sure this concept is clear, imagine that you have two particles, two balls, that are rolling on a plane, and they're rolling at the same speed and they're rolling in the same direction. So this is the motion that they are doing. Imagine now that the two balls are charged. And one is charged positively, and the other one is charged negatively. So that while they're moving this way, they actually feel the attraction of the electric force. So their motion is actually not anymore a straight line. A straight line on a plane, it's a particular case of geodesic. But their motion will become something like this, in which the two particles will end up touching in a point. So this is the description between two particles which have experienced no force. So the two particles are free. Here, when the two particles are experiencing a force. But now, this was on a plane. Now let's assume that you are on a sphere with your two particles or your two balls. And let's imagine that there's no force between them. And they're moving, as in here, parallel to each other along two different meridians. Well, you know that even though there's no, this is a poor drawing, but you know that even though there is no force between them, they will touch. They will come in contact at the North Pole. even though there's no force, because both meridian will touch at the North Pole. So this gives you an idea that you can mimic this kind of motion in which there is a force attracting the two particles by using a model in which there is no force, but the space where the particles are moving is curved and not flat. So in simple words, this is some sort of the idea behind the equivalence principle in general relativity and those little games you play down there. So I don't know if you've ever seen Einstein's equations. That's what they look like. I don't know who's the nerd that actually painted them on this abandoned thing in Colombia, but it's a picture that you can easily find on the internet. The consequences of this new description of gravity are of different types. Some consequences are more under control, and these are the consequences which simply tell us how the prediction of Newton's theory have to be modified accordingly to the ideas of special relativity and general relativity. And these modifications of Newton's law have been spectacularly confirmed by experiments in the solar system since 3 years after the theory was proposed. However, there's also regimes where the theory tells us about more funny things, such as black holes, things that to some extent have been observed, things that to some extent are understood. Now, you probably have received already a lot of information about what a black hole is, and probably also the idea that this concept is not exactly new nor related to Einstein, but already Laplace, more than 200 years ago, understood that if the velocity of light is finite, then there might be objects which are so massive that not even light can escape from them. Because you know the concept of escape velocity, like a rocket, in order to get out of the gravity attraction of the planet, needs to have enough speed to win the potential energy. And this enough speed is determined by the mass of the Earth. So if the speed of light is finite, there might be a massive enough object such that not even light will escape. So the concept of black hole then in general relativity becomes slightly more interesting, and it can be understood in terms of, I don't know, have you seen these pictures, like these ideas of light cones? You're a bit familiar with these things, no? So basically, simply, the understanding that we have now of a black hole is that the causal propagation of matter can only happen within a light cone. And basically, what's happening in a black hole is that the typical light cone that we experience at our small energies is going to be bent, and in particular, once you pass a point which is called the event horizon and which is not signed anyway, the light cone will be tilted in this way so that you're actually not allowed to go back anymore. Not only that, but on top of this, the light cone will become more and more tilted as you approach the internal singularity. And this is what shows us, for the first time, a problem of the theory, because the event horizon, it's something that it might be a problem for our understanding of causality, space and time, in the sense that we are not familiar with the fact that there is an invisible membrane, an invisible surface, that if we pass through it, then there's no way we can come back out, then there's no way we can exit this surface. We're not familiar with this concept, but mathematically, it's a concept that poses no big problems to the theory. In particular, this idea has been always used in science fiction movies, right? Because there's a long series of movies that make use of this idea in which there's an astronaut that passes this event horizon surface and goes towards the center of the black hole, and nothing happens to him on the surface, because the gravity on the surface of the black hole on the event horizon, it's actually stronger than if you're far away, but it's not a gravitational force that will actually destroy you. So you'll be able to actually pass through and see what's inside. The theory still makes sense to describe to you what's inside. The theory starts losing sense once you approach this internal singularity. By singularity, I mean the fact that the theory blows up. The theory starts to describe curvatures which are infinite, starts to describe tidal forces which are infinite. So the fate of the astronaut is doomed because he's going to be torn into pieces by the tidal forces, namely the fact that the gravitational attraction to my feet is different than the gravitational attraction to my head, but the difference is negligible. When I'm getting close to the singularity, this difference diverges, it becomes enormous, and I'm going to be torn apart. The reason why the theory is not really reliable at that stage is exactly because it predicts these divergences, these infinities. And now you probably know that if you are solving, I don't know, a second or what do you call it, second order equation or a first order equation, and your answer is infinite, you know, they probably want to be, you want to go again through your calculations in order not to get a bad mark, because that's typically not a good answer for your problem. And this is again the same situation in the theory. If the theory is telling you that the answer to a question is infinite, probably that's a sign that we have pushed the theory to a regime where it would not apply, namely Hooke's force, to a regime where actually the spring is broken. So we expect that those close to the singularity of the black hole, those might be the places where exactly the theory is breaking down. And in this description in which the astronaut is thrown apart, we should probably change this picture by taking into account a more fundamental theory that would make sense also at those scales, also in those situations, and not say simply infinite as an answer. This is a cooler picture of a black hole. So the reason why you in this picture, well, actually this is an imaginative picture, but this is a real picture, namely, this is taken from the center of some galaxy, if you can read NGC 7000 something. The thing around the black hole is what is called the accretion disk. This thing is so massive that it acts as a well, it sucks in all the matter that has around itself, and this matter is falling in spirals, and the friction between the different layers of the spiral causes electromagnetic radiation, which is the origin of these polarized jets, which are depicted here, and actually you can see also in zoomed out pictures of this galaxy. So we more or less believe that we know the black holes exist. The black holes exist, but it's interesting to actually, from a scientific point of view, to understand why we feel confident. Not because we can really see the black hole. As you can see, if anything, the center of this thing is purely white. Certainly it's not a black hole. So you won't see anything black. But it's interesting because what happens is that in order to describe, for instance, the rotation of the Earth around the Sun, you use the Newton potential. You use the description of gravity made by Newton. You know that the potential has a shape, and you compute the orbits according to this potential, and you find that these are exactly in accordance with what we observe. The description of a black hole produces a potential which is different from the potential described by Newton. And what you find is that these accretion disks are in agreement not with the motion caused by Newton's potential, but with the motion caused by the potential of a black hole in general relativity. So that's why you infer that that's really a black hole, because the theory that describes that object as a black hole predicts a movement for the objects around it, which is in accordance with what it observed experimentally. That is more or less the logic of the approach. And probably you have seen what I'm going to show you next, but a black hole, in particular the event horizon, what I was saying earlier, is something that is true that mathematically causes no problem, but it causes some problems in understanding what's really happening there. However, there's a simple analogy which probably you have seen with a waterfall, because the edge of a waterfall is exactly the event horizon of a black hole. Imagine that you are, so here in what happens in the sci-fi movie is that the astronaut that is falling in keeps sending back text messages or light beams home, and as soon as, and the closer he gets to the event horizon, the longer these messages take, because the gravitational well experiences becomes more intense, and so time gets more dilated, and it takes longer for his messages to go back home. And in particular, at some point, they get also weaker and weaker, and at some point, when he reaches this event horizon, no more messages will escape, because as we said, light cannot come out of it. And the simple example that maybe you've seen about this is instead of an astronaut falling inside the black hole, is a little creature on the surface of the water, perturbing the surface of the water as it flows towards the edge. If I perturb the surface of the water, I will have waves propagating symmetrically in all directions. And the closer I get to the edge, the weaker and slower the propagation of my waves will be in this direction back home, until I reach a point right on the edge where if I perturb the water, there'll be no waves propagating in this direction, only in that one. And then I fall in. The only difference is that in this picture here, we know how to describe what happens after I've fallen in, because we know that here it becomes more turbulent, but it becomes, again, liquid water. Whereas in there, we don't really know how to describe inside there yet. So this is the basics of general relativity. And these are important because now I'm going to tell you what are the basics of quantum mechanics, and so you might probably get a feeling of why it's so hard to try to put them together. So the basics of quantum mechanics, which I'm assuming also you probably have heard already, there's basically two main concepts which are new in the description of quantum mechanics. One is the indetermination principle. Heisenberger principle, namely the fact that there is a concept of incompatibility of observations. In classical physics, to describe the motion of an object, at each time you measure is a point, is a position, which will give you a point in your plot. And then you measure its velocity, which will give you a direction in your plot. And you reconstruct the trajectory in this way, and you reconstruct it uniquely. And from a given point, you have a deterministic prediction of what the evolution will be like according to your equations of motion. This changes dramatically in the quantum theory due to this new concept of incompatibility of observations, namely the fact that if you know the position, you do not know the velocity. And the reason for this is actually very intuitive. Because how do you know the position of, let's say, this chair? Because there's light on this chair, and so I can see where it is, and I can measure it by putting a rod next to it and use a reference system that, let's say, starts on me. So the main object that I need to interact with my, the simplest object that I need to interact with what I want to measure is light, okay? But now, imagine that you want to measure where a particle of light or where an electron is. You, again, have to hit it with a particle, with a light particle, okay, in order to see where it is, in order to measure it, its position with a rod. Except that this time, if that chair gets hit by my light beam, it's not going to really be affected by it. But if an electron is hit by a ray of light, it's a dramatic event for it. It's like saying, I'm trying to measure the position of this chair by crashing a car against it and seeing where the car bounces back. Well, I then know that the chair is going to be affected by this event. So that's the intuitive reason why this happened. That if I try to measure the position of an electron by putting light on it, then I'm going to change dramatically its motion because it's going to be hit by an energy content which is comparable with its initial motion. So this leads to the fact that if I know where I am, I don't know where I'm going, or if I know where I'm going, I don't know where I am. It's the concept that trajectories are not anymore deterministic, are not anymore a straight line or a definite line, but become fuzzy. Particularly, we talk of superposition of possibilities, namely, we don't really know. In classical mechanics, we know that the particle went from here to there following the classical solution to the equations of motions. In quantum mechanics, we don't really know if it was a solution of the classical equations of motions or not, the path that it took. We can only tell with which probability the particle is going to choose a particular trajectory. So the theory becomes not anymore deterministic, but a probabilistic theory. This is one key input. The other key input is the fact that crucial quantities turn out to be discrete in quantum mechanics. For instance, we gave an example earlier that this is the reason why nebulas show single color, why a hydrogen nebula in Orion would be just red and no other colors, is the fact that being the difference in the energy levels discrete, you can only have a discrete number of frequencies that you can actually excite. And this characteristic, which is present for the spectrum of the hydrogen atom, is also present in the spin of the electron. For instance, this is a very typical example. The spin of the electron, spins around his axis, but it spins only with a well-defined frequency, only with a well-defined angular velocity, either in one direction or in the other direction, but always with the same angular velocity. And this is a very lame clip, so let me skip it, please. So, how do we why is it so hard to put together this basic concept? So because generativity told us that this concept, the space-time is dynamical in the sense that if I want to describe the force of gravity instead of giving a force, I'm going to say that there's no forces, but the space-time is curved. Of course, the presence of the strength of the force and the characteristic of the force depend upon the matter context, because we know that gravity is created by matter and by energy, and so you see that the shape of this curved spacetime is going to depend on the matter content. And so there's going to be an interaction between the matter content and the curvature of the universe. And this interaction, the dynamics of this interaction is described by Einstein's theory. And the effect is that we cannot assume any more a fixed shape for spacetime, but we have to give up this idea and consider spacetime as a new dynamical entity that changes in time and changes accordingly to the matter content. However, quantum theory told us that dynamical quantities, such as a particle moving or an hydrogen atom, which has a rich dynamic of electric interactions between the electrons and the protons, are quantized. Where quantized means the fact that there's this notion of incompatibility of observations, and there's these consequences of discrete spectra, of discrete values for typical quantities like energy. So if we try to put together these two concepts, spacetime is dynamical, dynamical quantities are quantized, we end up with the fact that we should describe then spacetime in a quantum way. Okay, but what could be the quanta of space then? So we know that, for instance, the quantum of excitation of the electromagnetic field is a photon, which is the minimal quantity of light that you can send. It's a photon of a given energy. We know that, for instance, in the hydrogen atom, the quantum of excitation of the energy is the position of the electron in a radial orbit around the nucleus. What could be the quanta of excitation in the case of gravity? So because gravity is actually a theory of space-time, the quanta of gravity should be something like quanta of space-time, so little grains out of which, exciting which, you are reconstructing your space-time. But how can we reconcile this idea of grains of space as quanta of general relativity with the fact that there's no doubt that we experience an absolutely smooth space and time? And I can show you a nice idea about how you can understand this by doing some advertisement for holidays of a nice tropical beach. If you think about the sand on the beach, at this scale, when you're looking at this picture, it seems absolutely smooth. But then, of course, if you zoom in, you will see that actually the structure is granular. In the case of space-time, the funny thing is that this granular structure happens at a ridiculously small distance. 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. This means that from us, actually from the whole universe to the proton is much closer than from the proton to that scale. So it's ridiculously small scale. Nevertheless, this small scale, in spite of this discreteness, in spite of the fact that it happens at such a ridiculously small scale, it might have effect for the description that we feel on the macroscopic level on the sand. But they might have effect, but in spite of the fact that they might have effect, we haven't seen them. We haven't seen anything yet about this. We have absolutely no experimental evidence of how we can really make sense of these intuitive pictures of quanta space. So the situation is that we are lost in the dark. And there's actually even critiques towards the fact that this is just a purely theoretical question, it's not trying to answer practical questions like the Born quantum mechanics was born because there was a very practical question concerning the emission of a black body. So it was an experiment, it was giving a result. The theory that was in charge at the time could not explain that result. Planck had this other idea of using discrete sets of energies for the possible emissions and solve the problem. This is not the case for us. We have only these kind of theoretical problems. Namely, we see, yes, but if we could see inside the event horizon of a black hole, if we could see the very origin of the universe, then the theory that we have would not make sense. But it's not the same thing as we do have the result and we're trying to match it with our understanding. In this sense, it's a purely theoretical quest. And as I said, in spite of the fact that this purely theoretical quest has gone on for more than 70 years, there's still no consistent theory that makes predictions which are testable. By testable, I mean the fact that the theory predicts something, you compare it with some phenomenology, with some experiments, and then you say, okay, the theory is right, no, the theory is wrong. We don't have anything like this. We do have various candidates, though. The main ones are string theory, which is related to a particle physics point of view, which is By this I mean that the history of particle physics is extremely interesting. So what happened was that, and it's an history of proliferation of questions and understanding of the questions. Like, for instance, when Dirac find out about the existence of antiparticles through his equation, he thought that the antiparticle of the electron was the proton, because at that time the only particles that were known were the proton, the electron, and the neutron. So he thought, well, I was trying to describe a negatively charged particle. It turns out it has also a positive sector, positively charged sector. This must be the only other particle that we know. It turned out that that was not the case, that there was a new particle which wasn't observed at that time, that was observed shortly after, which increased the number of the particles that we saw. So in principle, increased the complexity of the world to describe, but that was immediately understood in terms of Dirac's equation. And this went on and on for the next 50 years, at least, until the late 70s, in which a proliferation of particles, the more and more to be understood, it actually could be done by simply including them in a unified description, which we had of the other three fundamental forces apart from gravity, which are the electromagnetic, the strong, and the weak force. So this was a path of proliferation of problems and solving those problems, which was extremely successful. And trying to apply this path to the fourth force that was left out, namely gravity, led to the many developments of string theory. There's another strong approach to the problem, which is, on the other hand, more based on the ideas of general relativity, not on this big success of particle physics. And this approach is called loop quantum gravity. You have to keep in mind, however, that there's many more ideas around. As I said, we don't have yet a theory that is well defined. Even worse, we don't really have experiments that we can use to test our theories. So every new idea is welcome, especially if it leads to possible phenomenology and concrete counterexamples. So, of course, in the following of my presentation, I'm going to be extremely unbiased and try not to show what my preferences are. However, so let me first say something about string theory.
Why do you call it the dark side? Not because they are mean. Well, some of them are, but
that's not the main reason. But first of all, I'm glad that you actually picked up the joke, because I thought that you guys were maybe too young for having seen Star Wars, and that would have made me felt extremely old. So thank you for that. Now, why I call it the dark side? Because like the dark side in the movie, it is very powerful and very charming. As I said, it's based upon an extremely long series of successes in particle physics. And it is very attractive and very charming to keep going along the same path. And it is very powerful because it uses the same tools and the same techniques that were used in particle physics, and which we know so well, and which we know they can be used in a very precise way in order to extract physical information and ask physical questions. However, it has also, these extremely interesting aspects, these extremely attractive aspects, but it leads to concepts which are a bit in contradiction with the experimental world that we see. In particular, it requires the idea of extra dimensions, which we know we live in three dimensions. So the idea of giving that up to go for the 11 dimensions of string theory, it's always a bit, feels weird. So why would you say that you live in 11 dimensions? When I was young, I thought it was because 11 is the number of players in a soccer team. So that must be the magic number. No, it's trickier than that. It's actually interesting. It's not a number that comes out of a hat. It has a very, very interesting origin. So imagine you have a spinning top. If you have a spinning top and you want to describe your spinning top, you typically, if you've done a little bit of physics, but if you soon do it, you'll learn that the first thing to do is to choose a clever reference system, to choose clever coordinates. Because if you choose the wrong coordinate system, even the simplest problem might become extremely hard to solve. So if you have a spinning top and you want to describe its motion, the clever reference system is to take an axis, let's say the z-axis, along the axis of spinning of the top. Nevertheless, the classical theory is invariant under, it has a symmetry, it's invariant under rotations. Namely, if I choose my reference system tilted with respect to the axis of the spinning top, the equations are going to be much harder, but the theory, but the description, the equations are going to be harder, but the physics that they describe is going to be exactly the same. So the theory is invariant under the symmetry there. The same is true in quantum mechanics. If you have an electron, the electron we said spins either like this, always at the same spin, but this is not referred to a single axis. It's referred to any axis you can choose. There's a symmetry under under rotations in space. So then there's a little bit of jargon. Let me teach you a little bit of jargon. If you have a classical system that shows a symmetry, and then your quantum description of the same system loses that symmetry, then you have a problem. And this problem is called anomaly. So if your description of the spin of the electron were to lose the symmetry under rotation, you will probably be happy to throw away your theory because of this anomaly. So what happens in string theory is that at the beginning somebody proposed this idea. Let's assume that actually all the particles are vibrating modes of a string. Well, it turns out that if you do this assumption, which you might like, you might not like, but anyway, you do end up having an anomaly. So the theory makes no sense when you try to apply to the particles which you see in four dimensions. Then you might have said, okay, I'm just simply throwing away this theory because there's an anomaly. But actually, it turned out something very interesting, namely that this anomaly, the presence of this anomaly was dependent on the dimension of space-time. And it turned out, in a tricky way, the numbers changed, but to keep the story short, it turned out that if space-time was 11-dimensional, then this anomaly was not there. So instead of saying, let's assume that the particles have vibrating modes of strings, oh, I do get an anomaly, okay, wrong idea, let's change the idea. Here, the attitude was more, let's assume that the vibrating modes, the particles have vibrating modes of a string, and let's assume the space-time is 11-dimensional. Then the theory makes sense. So these are a lot of assumptions that have to be, of course, tested against the experimental evidence that we have. And this is something that hopefully could be done at some point. But for the moment, we don't see anything like this, nor we see the other important requirement of string theory, which is the fact that each particle should have a supersymmetric partner. So this might look like an interesting idea, but the problem of this idea is the fact that it doubles the number of particles that we have. Now, as we said, this is not necessarily a bad thing. Dirac, with his antiparticles, doubled the number of particles that we were seeing, that we knew about, but they were seen. So if we double again the number of particles that we see, that we know, and then we see that could be still a viable way to go. So the state of the art of string theory is a bit confusing in the sense that the theory has been developed for more than 30 years in all possible different directions, with all possible description of supersymmetric matter and extra dimensions, including large extra dimensions as opposed to compact extra dimensions. So it's impossible for me to just wrap up all the ideas. But anyway, the problem is that as for all the other approaches, we still don't have a testable prediction that might allow us to test the theory against the experiment. So this was the brief look at the dark side. So I don't know. Do we have better news? Oh, no, I said I shouldn't be unbiased. So do we have different news? Yes. Oh, it's not starting, my thing. Okay, sorry. Shall I try again? It was hard to actually match the sound. The good guys come. Feel perfectly fine with you. So the story of quantum gravity is a bit shorter than the one of string theory because it only started in the late 80s, in fact. And as I said, it has nothing to do with the developments in particle physics. It has nothing to do with the initial idea of unifying the strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces. But it's really related to trying to make sense of this concept of quantum of space, of quantum space, namely quantizing this dynamical space-time that Einstein tells us. And we have seen that, for instance, when you quantize the hydrogen atom, a consequence that you get is that the energy levels, or if you want, the orbits of the electrons around the hydrogen atom are discrete. They can only, the electrons can only be at discrete values of the distance between the nucleus. So this discretization is something that happens also in loop quantum gravity in the following way, that if you consider a little region of space, so if space-time was smooth, you take this sphere, you could compute the area of this sphere, and you compute the volume of this sphere. These equations, these formulas, everybody knows them when the space is Euclidean, the space is flat. They become more complicated if the space is curved, but you can still always do it in the classical case and get, of course, continuous variables, because I can take the sphere and make it, suppose we are in flat space, I can take the sphere and make it slightly smaller, and the volume will change continuously, and the area will change continuously. What happens in the theory is that this is not anymore possible, but both the areas and the volumes of surfaces and regions assume only discrete values. So I cannot take a little region of space-time and just make the volume of this region arbitrarily smaller, but I have to go by discrete steps, just as I cannot take an electron in a hydrogen atom and move it and still be in an equilibrium orbit by moving it as little as I want, but I have to move it by a discrete step. So this is a key consequence of the theory. Of course, we don't really know yet if this key consequence is observable, because those energy spectrum, the distance between those energy levels, is at the Planck scale. So it would require a meter that is capable of telling apart distances of a Planck scale, which is something that we don't really know how to make sense of at this stage of understanding. So we don't really know if this discreteness is observable, but there might be consequences of this discreteness which are observable, and I will tell you later about this. Before, let me tell you how this discrete structure emerges. Because the basic object of typical particle physics are the fields that describe the classical fields that describe the forces and their quanta, their excitations. The basic object of loop quantum gravity is different. The basic object of loop quantum gravity is a graph. A graph in which all that matters is just how the nodes are related to each other. So I can make the image there of the space-time region, of the space region disappear, and all that matters is how is this graph and how the nodes in this graph are related to each other. And what happens in the theory is that each of those nodes carries a quanta of space. So each of these nodes is going to tell you what is the volume of the region around that node. And each of those links carries a quanta of area. So it's going to tell you, if you consider, for instance, these two nodes here, 1 and 2, there is a volume in the region around these, which is carried by this node. And there's a volume for the region around this node, which is carried by this node here. And then these two regions share an area, like imagine two air balloons touching. So there's an area of contact between the two of them. And the area of this surface of contact is given by a label which is attached to this link. So the fundamental object is weird. It's extremely different from the fundamental object that we use in the other approaches to physics. However, it's very much related to the basic ideas of general relativity, because one way of rephrasing these dynamics of space-time, these equivalence principle, is by saying that actually, and probably Lee has told you about this, is by saying that actually our concepts of physics should be relational, should not refer to an absolute space and time, but should only refer to relative positions and relative motions. And a graph is the perfect idea to implement this idea, because all that matters is the relation between the nodes of the graph. So you might be happy that in words this seems to make sense. The problem then is try to make sense of these in formulas in order to extract predictions, and in particular extract numbers which will not be infinite once again, as in our starting point, general relativity, because else this would be useless. So these are the big, what time is it now? I'm doing fine. So this is the basic building block of the theory, and it's called the spin network. Network, because network is just another word for graph. Spin, because those labels that are attached to the nodes and the links, and that give you the value of the quantum space, the value of the quantum area, are spin numbers. Namely, they behave like the spins of the electron. Imagine you have a set of electrons, each one with its own spin in different direction, and we apply their plus or minus value. And these labels share some properties with those quantum numbers there. That's why it's called the spin network. And this is what is called the fixed time description. So this is just a description for space. So as I said, the node carries a volume of space, not a volume of space-time. So it's a three-dimensional quantity. The links carry labels for areas, two-dimensional quantities. So out of a spin network, you can reconstruct a three-dimensional geometry. For instance, to give you a little bit more taste of what you could do, imagine you have a four-valent node. Then you can draw that sphere around it. You can simplify it by assuming that it's just a pyramid or tetrahedron in such a way that each of these links is puncturing one of the four triangles in the tetrahedron. And if your nodes has a higher valency, let's say five links, then you put five triangles, each of them is punctured only once, and you close them together to form a discretization of a sphere with five triangles, which I don't know how to draw. So let's go back to the tetrahedron, which is simpler to draw. And the idea of the theory is that this link is puncturing this triangle, so the spin carried by this link tells you about the area of this triangle. The spin carried by the node tells you about the volume of the tetrahedron. Because the spins can only assume discrete values, you know that there's particles of spin 0, spin 1/2, spin 1, spin 2. There's no particles of spin pi or square root of 2. Because the spins can only take these discrete values, also the areas and the volume in this tetrahedron can only take discrete values. So in this sense, the geometry is discrete. I can change the geometry of this tetrahedron only by discrete steps. For instance, increasing the area here by a spin step. So this is basically the way the theory works at the microscopic level. And then if you have a complex graph like that one on top, you have many of these little chunks of space all glued together. And the way they're glued together and their geometrical information tells you about the curvature of this space. So in this way, you can describe spaces which are flat and spaces which are curved. The curvature of these spaces is going to be not a continuous quantity like in general relativity, but it's going to be a discrete quantity, exactly for what we said, because you can only change by discrete amounts or the geometrical properties. So this is the picture of fixed time. And because it's good to give cool words, it is called spin networks. Another cool word is I should have said a little bit more, maybe. Then let me postpone about the other cool word, because another thing that I wanted to say is that how is this theory... So this theory is not only implementing that one idea of discreteness that we have in quantum mechanics, it's also implementing that other idea of incompatibility between the observables. Because let me go back to this example of the tetrahedron. There is, as I said, you have the link... You have four links and a node. So you have the four labels on the four links, and you have one label on the node. So in total, you have five labels. These five quantum numbers, you can think of them as the quantum numbers for an electron in the hydrogen atom. N, which tells you the radius, L, which tells you the shape of the orbital, and M, which tells you the shape in the Z direction, and then MS, that tells you if it's spinning plus or minus. So it has four quantum numbers. This problem will have five quantum numbers. However, let me go back to the idea of incompatibility. If you have a classical particle, you want to know for each point, you want to know two quantities, the position and the velocity. However, you know that you can measure only one at a time. So you have only one quantum number, either the position or the velocity. And the reason, and the fact that you have less quantum numbers than classical numbers is the reason why you then end up having these fuzzy trajectories. Here, the situation is exactly the same, because if I want to describe the classical geometry of a tetrahedron, I know that I need six numbers classically. For instance, a tetrahedron, you can draw it yourself, it has six edges. If I give you the six lengths of these edges, the geometry is completely fixed. But I need six, I cannot give you only five. If I give you only five, then there's an infinite number of tetrahedra that I can construct by just changing the length of the sixth edge. So in order to fix it uniquely, classically, I need six numbers. However, the quantum theory is only five. So we are in a similar situation of the classical trajectory of a particle. The geometry associated with a few quantum states like this is going to be a fuzzy geometry. And this is the space geometry. Let's now try to see what the dynamic would look like in such a funny picture. And this is the other cool word that you can learn today, and this is the spin foam. Now, spin network, I told you where it comes from. Spin foams comes from an old idea of Wheeler that he said that on small scales, the undetermination principle by Heisenberg would have made the geometric structure of space-time being completely fuzzy, probably looking something like a foam. And that's why Wheeler called this in the 60s the space-time foam at the Planck scale, at the microscopic scales where generativity should be quantized. Because in this particular theory, the labels describing the dynamics of this foam are spins, the name got changed into spin foams. That's the origin of the name. And how is the dynamics described? So if you have a particle, you know how to describe the dynamic, you solve the equations of motion. A typical way to solve the equations of motions, which you will learn in the future, is by probably the way that you already know is looking at F equal ma, so Newton's equations of motion. However, a couple of centuries later, a Scottish guy named Hamilton produced a more clever way of describing classical equations of motions. And instead of using F equal ma, you use a different set of equations, which looks exactly like Newton's one in the regimes where you can write both. And this guy was named Hamilton. And so the main function that tells you what the equations of motions will look like, it's called the Hamiltonian function. So in classical, this is already classical mechanics in the 19th century. It was late 19th century. It was described in terms of the Hamiltonian function, not anymore in terms of F equal ma. So when you want to study the dynamic of a classical system, you look for the Hamiltonian of that system. And this you can do it also at the quantum level. As we said earlier, you can study a system, you can study the symmetries of a system at the quantum level and at the classical level and check for anomalies. You can study the Hamiltonian, you can study the dynamics at both levels using this function. So what would this function look like for a system like this? So we know that, for instance, for a pendulum, what the Hamiltonian tells us is that if you start from a configuration with an initial angle and initial velocity, your subsequent motion will be the one that you can compute and compare with experiments. For the electromagnetic field, we know that if we start with a configuration of the fixed time of the electric field, we make it evolve in time, and according if there are sources or not, the electric field will behave in a very predictable way. For these graphs, the action of the Hamiltonian constraint is funnier than what we are used to. And what happens is that it changes the graph, in fact. So if you have a node in your graph, and remember that a node means that you have a little chunk of space, the action of the Hamiltonian constraint is going to change this little part of space-time locally into something that would look like this. From a node, you would move to three nodes, so to three little chunks of space-time. So like you had one, and all of a sudden, three pop up from the same region. To give you an idea of how this happened, imagine you have a network like this, and this node is going to be opened up by the action of the Hamiltonian, like this. So that if you have a time variable to describe, to parameterize this evolution in time, it will look like this. You start with a graph in which you have a single chunk of space there. Here, the Hamiltonian acts, and it splits it in three chunks. Okay, so this is what the simplest spin foam would look like. The evolution of a graph with triplication and other moves caused by the Hamiltonian operator or by the Hamiltonian function. Mm-hmm. So the difference with respect to the initial graph is that while the initial graph was simply characterized by nodes and links between the nodes, this form is characterized by surfaces as well. So a more generic and nicely looking example of a form would be something like this. And you see that this time you have surfaces, links, and nodes. And they're all related to each other in a precise way. And that's the image of what a spin form is like. And so the idea is that this kind of surface represents at the microscopic Planck scale level the essence of spacetime. So spacetime turns out to be discrete. You can only have discrete values for your quantities, for your geometrical quantities. Turns out to be fuzzy, because you cannot know exactly the semi-classical geometry in a precise way, but only in this fuzzy way, like for the trajectory of a free particle in quantum mechanics. And turns out to be confusing, because what do we do now with this crazy picture of spacetime at the microscopic scale? One problem is the fact that now, not only this description is so far off from the usual description of spacetime in the physics that we know, but also the languages, the mathematical language, so the technical tools that are used to describe this picture, namely the tools of graph theory, this fuzziness that I described earlier, are very different from the languages that are used in particle physics. So the problem is, how do we extract? How do we ask questions? Because really here, the problem is that when you start to address the problem of quantizing gravity, you don't even know anymore what question to ask. Because like, for instance, I don't know, a classical physicist could ask, OK, you have a particle? Nice. What's the mass of that particle? And a classical physicist in the 19th century would have answered the number. However, you have done a special relativity. You've seen that the mass is not a preserved quantity. So a special relativity physicist would answer, wait a second, what do you mean, what's the mass? The mass with respect to which observer? It changes, right? And then, but still, they saved because he said, OK, forget about the mass. Just tell me what's the energy. What's the invariant mass of the particle? And then he's still safe. He can answer that question with a number. In general relativity, you even lose that. Unless you have a particular conditions, not even energy is conserved in general relativity. In fact, the essence of Einstein's equations of motion is that the total energy content of the universe is zero, where by total I mean the energy of matter plus the energy of gravity. So the energy of matter alone is not conserved, but is in a continuous exchange with the energy of gravity. So the equations are typically written in this funny form. But really what it amounts to is saying energy of the gravitational field plus energy of matter equals zero. So this is basically the content of those equations. So what is conserved is the total amount of energy, not just the energy of matter. So even the special relativity physicist gets lost in this context. So we don't even really know what are the right questions to ask. So the situation is certainly more complicated than in other approaches such as string theory, because for instance, what happens in string theory is that you do not quantize this full idea of spacetime, but you still assume the spacetime is flat, spacetime is continuous, and the only thing that is quantized is the little ripples of spacetime. What are these ripples of spacetime? You've heard probably that Einstein's theory of gravity is a field theory. One thing that a field, what does that mean? Well, one thing that it means is that typically all field theories have waves as at least approximate solutions. And this is also the case with Einstein's theory, and the waves are called gravitational waves. And you can think of them as causing, if they're small, these waves, you can think of them as causing ripples on the surface of spacetime, just as well as a wave would cause ripples on the surface of a lake. So if you describe, then you can, this is a classical description, then what you typically tend to do in string theory is that, okay, perfect. Then let me take the lake fixed, classical. So I do have a concept of energy, I do have all the mathematical tools that I have in ordinary particle physics, and let me just quantize these ripples. So the ripples will be quantized. Okay, so that's nice, but not the lake, not the whole lake. So what turns out is that this approach, which you might like or not like from a philosophical point of view, anyway is problematic from a technical point of view, because these waves interact with itself. So they tend to be bigger and bigger. They don't just die off as would the waves on a lake do. They try to become bigger and bigger. And if they become bigger and bigger, they're going to affect the surface of the lake. So this initial assumption in which the lake is still, and the waves are small, loses meaning. And this technical problem leads to many conceptual issues, in fact, that have to be solved. So we don't have this problem of the fact that the waves self-interact, because we are quantizing the whole of space-time since the very beginning. We're not making assumptions on the flatness of the initial situation over which we just quantize ripples. On the other hand, we have the disadvantage that we lose words, we lose language, we don't know how to ask questions. Nevertheless, we have reasons to expect that these discreteness that we obtained might be very useful to understand better those regimes that I was telling you at the beginning, where the theories sort of lose meaning, and also that in spite of the fact that they happen at the Planck scale, they still might affect our low energy physics, and so they might be visible at some point. I was supposed to correct this spelling, but nostalgia of Italy, let me put it like this. So why, for instance, the discreteness of space-time would be a solution of the problem of singularities, which I told you before? Because I told you that in the singularity, in the inside, in the center of a black hole, the tidal forces would diverge, the curvature of space-time would diverge, everything would become infinite, the astronaut would be torn apart. However, let's now go back to this idea here, that space-time is made out of these little chunks glued together. And as I told you, not only the geometry of these chunks is discrete, but also the curvature that you can describe by gluing them together is discrete, only allows certain values. In particular, that's a technical word. In particular, it doesn't allow for divergences anymore in the curvature. So the curvature cannot anymore in this theory become infinite. So if there is a description of a black hole in this theory, this black hole will certainly not have a singularity, because the curvature could not go to infinite. So the question is, A, is there a black hole in this theory? And B, so what happens there? So the answer to the first question is yes, there is a description of a black hole in this theory. The black hole has no singularity inside. And the answer to the second question is that, in fact, what happens is that in this theory, according to the models that we have so far, space-time will continue past the X singularity, which is not a singularity anymore. The curvature, instead of blowing up to infinity, reaches a maximal value, at which, if you are small enough or strong enough, you will not blow up, you will not be torn apart, and then you can continue moving. So the theory predicts, in case we can access the interior of an event horizon of a black hole, that there will not be a singularity inside, but space-time will continue. And there's actually a similar prediction for the Big Bang. So from models, it seems that also the initial singularity of the Big Bang in this theory is not present anymore, so that it is more consistent, the picture in which actually the universe was bouncing off. So it was shrinking, it reached this minimal size, not a zero size, not an infinite curvature behavior, just a regular, very high curvature behavior, but not infinite, and then bounced back off. And that was the Big Bang. These are just models, not definite answers from the theory, but show how you can move over from the concept of singularities, where your theory blow up using this concept of discreteness. Furthermore, as I was saying, it can affect the description of matter, even though it happens at such short scales. And this is because, again, of quantum mechanics. One of the consequences of quantum mechanics is the fact that the higher the energy in a particle, the actual smaller the size of this particle is. And this is a consequence of, from the very beginning of the quantum mechanics in the 20s of the Heisenberger uncertainty principle, which means that, think about this tarp surface. If I use a soccer ball, I won't feel the discreteness of, the roughness of the turf. But if now I'm kicking my soccer ball so hard, but actually shrinking to a size of a centimeter or so, then the ball will feel the roughness. And instead of having a nice, smooth rolling motion, you will start to have a bumping motion in which you will feel the discreteness of space-time. So this gave rise to an idea that maybe if we look at very high energy particles, which comes from, let's say, cosmic rays, so which have traveled a long distance in the universe, always at this high energy, they've had the time to actually accumulate all these little bumps, which they might feel because they are so small, effectively, and accumulate all these little bumps, and so their motion has changed a little bit from the classical motion that we would have expected, and so we might be able to measure it. So this, in principle, could be possible, and we actually thought, forget about the formulas, just the plot, we actually thought at some point that we might be seeing it, because if, so the projected, just this to give you an idea of how you could compare your possible prediction with experiments. So if the particles were supposed to not feel this bumpiness at all, this roughness at all, so if space-time is smooth until the Planck scale, then you would expect a behavior for this particular experiment about cosmic rays like this plot here. Whereas if there is a deviation from this behavior that might be due to bumpiness in the microscopic structure of space-time, you might have seen particles being higher up with respect to this knee here. Most of the experiments actually gave the particles exactly on the expected line, apart from one. This is a Japanese experiment, which gave the particles way up there, as you can see, with big errors. But nevertheless, for like a year, people were super excited about this because they said, oh, this might be the first evidence that we're actually seeing some predictions from quantum gravity. Of course, the world is not that nice towards us, so these points were then immediately, a couple of years later, brought back down here. So this evidence is absolutely not there. If this plot nowadays shows something, it shows that space-time is smooth, not discrete. Nevertheless, it was just to give you an idea. And so to conclude, we have in this approach, we have this idea in which we start from this graph, which is the basic building block of the theory. This graph gives a granular description of space-time, in which you have discrete quanta. The geometry is discrete and also fuzzy. And then we know that there must be, if this theory makes sense, then there must be a regime in which it smooths out to a nice holiday location like that one. So to conclude, the path is paved, it's ahead of us, and let's try not to get lost. Thank you. I killed everybody. It's your last day, right? So even if you make a fool of yourselves, you'll be away very soon. Don't be ashamed. Please. That's an active field in that is developing. It's called the field of phenomenology of quantum gravity. And there's ideas of how to try to test this. The main difficulty, so there's other ideas which involve, for instance, interferometry. Interferometry means you send a wave in that direction, you send a wave in that direction, we both have a mirror, they come back, they might interfere because they've done different paths that you expect at the beginning. There's ideas like this. The key point that has to always be kept in mind is that actually not even the classical prediction of gravitational waves has ever been seen. Because even the classical gravitational waves are so small that all our efforts so far in 40 years, since the field is actually old, of trying to experimentally detect them, have ever succeeded. So the quantum effect that you might be looking for, in principle, you should expect them to be smaller than the classical waves. Okay, like saying that a photon is in some sense a smaller effect than a wave of the electromagnetic field, which is a full ray of light. Okay, so because the classical waves itself, it's so hard to detect, that gives you an idea of how hard it is actually to detect also the quantum gravitational effects. Nevertheless, as I said, the field is in sort of development, and this is the main idea, the idea of trying to look for, it's technically it's called modification in the dispersion relations of particles, namely the fact that as they propagate, the relation between the energy and the momentum of the particle changes due to this microscopic structure. However, there's other effects. For instance, Li is a fan of non-locality effects. So if your basic object is a graph like this, then you might wonder, okay, as we said, all that matters is the link between the nodes. Fair enough. Now, what if I have a link that relates this node to that node there? Well, are these two links close or not? I mean, they're close with respect to this one link, because they're related only by one link. But they seem far with respect to the fact that there's so many other nodes in between. So this is what you might call a non-local effect, because these two links are not local in the sense of the graph, because they're far apart, but they're nevertheless related. So effects like these might also have consequences. So in our understanding of the propagation of particles, for instance. And this is another investigation that could be pursued. But the field is active, as I said, and in fact, in November, we're going to have a workshop exactly on trying to understand how effective models. So forget about the full theory. Just take basic assumptions of the theory, like the existence of non-local links, and try to see what are the consequences that you might effectively see. So it's an active field in development. In fact, I also had another clip. So from that graph, you remember, you take this picture of tetrahedrons and triangles. And so some guys did this animation of what the action of the Hamiltonian, so what the evolution of this initial space, triangulated space made out of just triangles and tetrahedra, would look like under the action of the Hamiltonian. And what happens in this evolution is that, as I said, you get more nodes, which means you get more tetrahedra, so more triangles. But also another thing that changes is the labels. You remember you had labels, right, on these triangles telling you the area of the triangle, the volume of the tetrahedron. These labels also change under the evolution. The things become bigger or smaller. And in this clip, they have pictured the value of the labels with colors. So the colors, the change of the colors shows
changes in the labels. It's better when you find it on YouTube.
Oh, right, yes. Well, I suppose that was mainly for technical reasons, so that you could actually see something. But yes, if you think about this discrete surface as just a collection of tetrahedra, and then the way it folds together, it might fold in such a way that there's empty spaces in between. So not only the geometry is fuzzy, but in fact also another important characteristic, which is called the topology, becomes also fuzzy and not well determined from the very beginning. The topology is basically the characteristic that tells you if you have holes in spacetime. So if your spacetime is like a sphere, that there's no holes, you can walk all the way. Or if it's like a donut, there's a big hole. The way you realize is not because you fall in the hole because you're not allowed to, but the way you realize it is that because there's a different number of motions that you can do to come back to the same place. That's what tells you if your spacetime has a topology with holes or not. And to some extent, you can imagine that also that characteristic will be fuzzy at that scale, at those scales. Hopefully not at our scales here, because our description that we have is a description of a fixed topology and a fixed geometry. There's no doubt about that. So there's no doubt that whatever fancy the microscopic structure is from the theory, then if the theory makes sense, there must be a way to extract from it the boring behavior that we see at our scales.